Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Andrew Peach with the Happy Pod, talking to the people at the heart of the world's positive news stories. Roy in the Philippines is enjoying it. When there's so much stressful news, says Roy, it provides him with an oasis of good vibes each week. And Bonnie got in touch from Dubai.
I tend to do a lot of doom scrolling, unfortunately, on things like Twitter. And it's a very, very bad habit. And to break myself of it, I listen to podcasts that are a little more uplifting. And yours has been just such a huge help in the past few weeks. I hate to use catchy words, but a really good vibe, you know?
Thanks to Bonnie, to Roy, and to everyone who's been in touch. This week we'll hear from Melbourne, Shanghai, Stockholm and Wellington. There's news of secret messages in your body odour.
We know that if a person is in a state of fear, their sweat can be perceived by another person through the chemosignals in the sweat.
A taxi for dogs in China.
I've been looking at comments on Sina Weibo, which is China's equivalent of a platform like Facebook or Twitter. And people have been saying they think it's a fantastic idea and they're hoping to see similar services in their cities.
And a world record breaker in a tent.
I've had a brilliant 3 years, one of the best 3 years of my life. I thought, come in now whilst we finish on a high and we can focus on adventures for the future.
All on the way in the Happy Pod. You're out with your metal detector in the gold fields of Victoria in Australia, wondering what you can find. The metal detector goes off and you think you've found a gold nugget, but how much will it be worth? You take it to the only prospecting shop in Geelong, southwest of Melbourne, where you're about to give Darren a big surprise.
A chap bought in a backpack and he said, I've got something to show you. And look, normally prospectors come into the shop and they'll show me a rock that looks like gold or a rock with a bit of fool's gold in it, which tricks a lot of people. And he said, I've got something to show you. And out of his backpack, he pulled this rock about probably 3/4 the size of a brick. And he dropped it into my hand. And as he dropped it into my hand, he said, do you think there's $10,000 worth of gold in it? And my wife said that when my hand dropped with the weight, so did my jaw. I just couldn't believe it.
Because obviously you deal with this stuff all the time. Someone, you know, comes in and says, will you have a look at this? So far, so good. And then puts a lump in your hand that's so heavy, it's clearly going to be worth a lot more than 10,000.
Yeah, I've been detecting for 43 years and you know that there's more than 10,000 in that rock. When I said, oh, look, there's 100,000 probably in that rock, he looked at me and he said, oh, that's only half the rock. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh, I've got the other half at home. I got the sound with the metal detector. I dug up the rock and I couldn't see any gold. So I broke it in half expecting to find a nugget inside. And so there was two halves, not the one. So about 2 weeks later, he brought the two halves of the rock into me. And I just knew that there was going to be loaded with gold. And he dropped it off to me. And I'd done a test on the rock to find out how much gold was in it. And he called back and I said, I've got some good news for you. There's 83 ounces of gold in that rock, which today equates to about $240,000 Australian.
So what's happened now? He's taken his two halves of rock away and is he going to sell them? I suppose he must do.
Yeah. Look, when I told him the price of it, he said, are you interested in buying it? And I thought, oh, yeah, but I better check with the wife first because that's a lot of money. And I put in an offer. He went home and I presume that he's rang up other gold buyers and that. And he just rang me up. He said, I'm happy with the price. It's yours. So I had to scramble and clean out three bank accounts.
Yes.
And bought it. Like I said, in my 43 years of prospecting, I've never seen something of this size in a rock with that amount of gold in it. It's just very unique.
And what about the guy who found it? What's he done with the money? Is he still going out with his metal detector to try and find some more?
Well, the detector he found it with, it's a Minelab Equinox 800. Now, they're only about a $1,200 machine here in Australia, but they're a coin and treasure machine. And there's dedicated gold machines, but he found it with one of these $1,200 machines. Now, to get a reasonable gold machine, you're looking at, you know, between $4,000 and $10,000. So he is going to buy a proper machine off me that goes down a lot deeper. And who knows, I could be talking to you in a few months again.
That was Darren Gamp with me from Geelong, just southwest of Melbourne. Many of us love camping, but would you choose to camp out in your own garden every night for 3 years? Max did. He set a new world record for the most money raised by camping in doing so. It all started in 2020 when he was 10 years old, and it ended this week when the boy in the tent raised $900,000 for charity. Max took me back to the beginning in the early days of the COVID pandemic.
So my neighbour Rick unfortunately died of cancer, but before he died he gave me a tent and said, Max, I want you to have an adventure in it. And I said, I promise you I will.
How have you ended up sleeping in a tent for 3 years?
I kind of fell in love with it, really. I've always loved the outdoors. I've always been a scout. I've always loved it. I've gone out camping with my friends loads. My dad's a Royal Marine, so of course the outdoors is what he loves. And every little minute we love going outside, doing sports, going camping, going kayaking, surfing. And I think the outdoors is just one of the best places for me.
Tell me what it's like at night. I mean, you're perfectly safe, obviously, but tell me what the experience is like.
Sometimes it's brilliant. Sometimes it's lovely. Some nights it's absolutely horrific.
Tell me about the good nights, first of all. When it's lovely, what's that like?
Well, it depends. It can either be you're listening to the rain and you're listening to the wind, and that's always quite nice to fall asleep to, and it's just quite calming. And sometimes when you wake up you hear the birds, and they're always the nights that you feel quite peaceful.
And what about the nights when it's horrible?
Listening to the rain, watching the rain creep into the tent, watching the wind blow your tent to your face. So basically it's just the weather. So either the weather's really nice to you and you love it, or the weather's really horrible to you and you're stuck in a tent and you find it really grim.
And it becomes a challenge. So I guess the next question is, you're doing this for enjoyment, you love being outside. On the days where the rain's hammering down, the water's coming into the tent, why don't you go in the house?
I've always said to myself, I don't want to come in because I went, you know what, I don't want to sleep out here because it's cold or it's wet. That was always not an option for me. The options were of coming in was if I wasn't finding it fun anymore, if I wasn't enjoying it anymore. They were the only ways I'd come in. And I mean, another key motivation is just trying to get away from the parents.
Of course, understandably. Tell me about your decision then to bring this to an end.
We always knew it had to come to an end at some point. Of course, this all started because I was going to do the first lockdown and try and do it through COVID. And I wanted to make sure that I could raise money for the Northern Hospice whilst all their fundraising was shut. I thought, you know what, I've had a brilliant 3 years, one of the best 3 years of my life. I thought, what a not a better idea to come in now whilst we finish on a high and we can focus on adventures for the future.
Because for someone of your age, a huge amount has changed in 3 years. I mean, that's a significant chunk of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm just thankful for the last 3 years. They've been ups and downs, but I think they're moments I'm going to remember from the rest of my life.
Tell me about going to Downing Street.
That will be a day I'll always remember. I thought it was going to be a lot more formal, but I think I spent most of the time at Downing Street chasing after Boris Johnson's dog.
The boy in the tent, Max Woosey, now 13 years old. There's a new taxi firm in Shanghai, only this taxi firm is for dogs. So say you'd like to take your dog for a walk in your lunch break at work, but your lunch break isn't long enough to go all the way home to collect your animal. Well, the taxi service will do it for you, meet you in the park. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen takes up this shaggy dog story.
So this is a woman who's in her 30s and she's basically set up a job that's a weekend job. And she decided that she wanted to become a dog taxi driver. So a taxi driver specifically for dogs, because she said that she felt there was a hole in the market where people were trying to arrange it, you know, just go to the park and get a taxi and take their pets with them. And they were finding that they were constantly being refused.
Right. So lots of taxi drivers don't want to have dogs. So is this about taking the dog and their owner to a park to go for a walk, or just the dog?
It can be just the dog. There is a recognition that because sometimes, especially post-COVID, people are working weekends, it's a way for them to get their dogs to them straight after work so that they can just enjoy the most time as possible. And there's a lovely video that's been appearing in Chinese media today showing basically all of these dogs just hopping in and much like you'd see a normal passenger, it's the dog that's sat in the seat and is quite happy just to be taken to its owner.
I mean, it makes it look like some kind of school minibus, right? Where the, you know, one dog hops in, another dog hops in, and they're all happily in there together. I don't suppose it can really be like that, but it's certainly been told into a lovely story in the social media video.
Oh, definitely. Yes. This woman, Miss Liu, said that she's been given the nickname the dog bus driver. And she has proven very successful so far. She said that she's been earning lots of money from this. And yeah, it's still a very new business. But this is nowadays, it's a trend post-COVID that a lot of young people in China, I mean, I've seen statistics suggesting that 1 in 5 have really struggled to find employment. And people love dogs, people love pets, and she's recognised that this is a good idea, saying that she's, you know, some people she's spoken to, they've told her that for every 5 or 6 calls they've made to taxis, they've just been refused. And this is a way that she can spend time with dogs, earn a bit of money, and drive around the city. It's
absolutely
a lovely story.
So, I mean, the world over, people will know of dog walking businesses where someone will walk your dog for you. But I can't say I've ever heard of this anywhere where someone will go and pick your dog up and bring it to you in your lunch break or when you finish work, so you don't have to do the transport part. You can just have the fun walking part.
I think it's a lovely story, and it's definitely a sign now that China's come out of its long 3-year zero COVID policy that people are getting back on their feet, that they're starting to get out and spend more time outdoors again.
What reaction has there been in China to this lovely video appearing from Shanghai on social media? What have people been saying?
Oh, people love it. I've been looking at comments on Sina Weibo, which is China's equivalent of a platform like Facebook or Twitter. And people have been saying they think it's a fantastic idea and they're hoping to see similar services in their cities. They think it's a lovely, heartwarming idea, and it's a side business for this woman. It could be a side business for many people who like animals.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. We love hearing your happy news. Email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This is 6-year-old Mario in Spain telling us about his first goal.
I want to send you my messages because at the beginning I didn't like football. And then I went to practice and I met a lot of friends and I have a lot of fun. I was playing in a game and one player of my team passed the ball to me and I shot so hard that the goalkeeper touched the ball and he went inside and I was very happy. When I saw that it was goal, and all the people shouting, and my friends came to me to hug me, and I was so happy and a little bit nervous.
Congratulations, Mario. Lovely hearing from you. Thanks to Dad Gerardo and Mum Isabel, who you heard cheering there, for getting in touch. Here's the sound that our listener Andrea in Italy loves to hear. Andrea says the sound of his 1958 125 Vespa makes him happy while he rides the streets of Rome. And in New Zealand, Andrew in Wellington says he likes the noise his dog makes drinking water after he's had a play. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This is Andrew Peach. Still to come, stories from Kenya, Namibia and the US, where we'll meet the college lecturer lifting the spirits of his students.
As an artist, I spend so much time looking at the shadow side of life, which is necessary. But in my public life, I really like to give people a little bit of positivity as much as I can.
Now, we usually try to avoid other people's body odour, but what if sweat contained hidden messages that could make us feel calmer, happier even? Researchers in Sweden think sweat could offer therapy for social anxiety. One of them is Vladimir Carley.
For example, we know that if a person is in a state of fear, their sweat can be perceived by another person through the chemo signals in the sweat. There is research around this, and it makes sense from the evolutionary perspective, because if you think about it, if someone is in a state of danger, then communicating this state of fear and danger to other people would set also the other people to be able to act on it. And more recently, there have been some research findings that are a bit weaker, that also states of happiness can be messaged through these chemo signals.
If you're feeling elated, if you're feeling happy, other people can tell without you needing to tell them or show it on your face. Their bodies just know.
Yeah, of course. Exactly as we can see cues of somebody being happy by visual cues, by looking at their faces, or, for example, auditory cues by listening to their tone of voice, we can perceive that also through their smell.
Is it catching? Is happiness catching? If people around you are transmitting happy vibes through their perspiration, does that have an effect on the mood of people around them?
We found this in a group of people with social anxiety. This was a very exploratory study. So we were investigating if the emotional component of the odor, so being an odor collected from a person in a happy state or in a fear state, would have different effects on people with social anxiety. And actually, we didn't find differences. So we found that both the odors had the same effect. They increased the effectiveness of treatment for social anxiety in comparison with a control group that was exposed only to clean air and not to a body odor. So our hypothesis here is that it's more of a human presence effect, also because the treatment was delivered through a mobile app. It was not delivered by a human. So one possibility that now we're testing in further studies is that it's the idea of human presence that was given by the odor actually augmented, increased the effectiveness of this mobile app for mind.
And I was just thinking about building on the research you've got. You now know about some of the secret messages that are being communicated from one person to another. Is there any way we can use that in order to help people with social anxiety, those kind of things?
Yeah, absolutely. We see that the effects of an existing treatment for social anxiety, it's significantly increased. It's 40% more effective. That's a lot. And that means that especially in a world where we lack healthcare personnel and we're moving to these digital treatments, and enhancing these treatments with an odor could be very valuable.
Vladimir Carli in Sweden. My next guest is a great teacher. You can tell that by listening to him. You can tell because when he left his job lecturing students in New York about poetry, they got him the sort of leaving gift only a really great teacher would get. It's a book of the craziest things that Joseph Fasano has said in class, which they'd carefully noted down. The book is 152 pages long.
It was quite a thing to be presented with. And of course, I was mortified as I was going through them. They have a wonderful sense of humor, my students, and, you know, took things out of context, certainly captured just about every expletive I might have said in passing.
They must have written down every word you ever said, I should think.
I suppose. I'm very passionate when I teach, and I at least I hope that came across to them.
Now, I'm just looking at some of the extracts that people have been reading on social media, some of my favourites. What led you to say, leave my mother out of it?
That one is an eternal mystery to me. I think perhaps we might have been talking about Hamlet, my favourite play, and I might have said something about mothers and Gertrude, and somebody in their wonderfully creative way wanted to psychoanalyze me, and I think I probably dashed off that comment. But I don't know for sure.
When did Joseph Fasano say, who taught you that love or learning was supposed to be easy?
You know, that's something that I'm so passionate about with my students, because I actually find that students these days really do want to be challenged. They don't want to be as infantilized as maybe some of the public narrative tells them they're supposed to be. And so we have a great ongoing conversation about that. And I think it's really wonderful to discover that students really do want to be challenged. I can't remember the exact context, but it was, I'm sure, in reference to that conversation.
And at one stage you talked about spending years and years destroying your life, which we should be alarmed by, but actually you're just describing your career as a writer.
Exactly. I often get that question, not just, you know, from my students, but when I'm giving a reading and there'll be a Q&A session afterwards. And invariably, much as I would when I was in that position, someone will ask me, you know, how do you write, particularly how do you write your first book? I sort of always have a somewhat humorous way of saying, well, you really just need to lock yourself in a room and, you know, risk poverty and risk doing some damage to your personal life. Of course, I don't think making art has to come with suffering, but my students certainly know what I mean by that.
I mean, listening to you, people listening to us now on the Happy Pod will be able to tell that you must be the lecturer everybody wants to have, because you're not weary about the whole thing. You're, you know, witty about it and passionate about it and all those things that students, I'm sure, can really buy into.
I hope so. I've been doing it now for 15 years, and it really is a passion of mine. I think it's important to meet students where they are and to, you know, not view the world apocalyptically, but rather try to learn from them, learn about the ways that they think, the way that they speak. And that can help us as people. It can help me as a writer. So I do. I have a good time with them.
The whole idea of this podcast is that the world is not full of doom and gloom entirely. There are all sorts of positive things going on in it. And I can tell that spiritually you're with us.
I am with you on that. I think it's so important. You know, I mean, as an artist, I spend so much time looking at the shadow side of life, which is necessary. But in my public life, I really like to, you know, to show that light and to, you know, to give people a little bit of positivity as much as I can.
The writer and lecturer Joseph Fasano with me from New York. Now, let's celebrate the work of Dr. Helena Ndume. Helena is an ophthalmologist who's made it her mission to eradicate the epidemic of preventable blindness in Namibia and other underprivileged communities. She's helped tens of thousands of people and has now been recognised in the Forbes 50 over 50 list.
It is very humbling. It gives us energy to move on to eradicate preventable blindness, especially on the African continent. No money in this world can pay for the happiness of someone who was once blind. And then after the surgery, that takes 15 minutes. And then they say, "Doctor, I've been blind for 10 years. Thank you very much, my daughter, that I can see." There are so many people who are involved in helping me to fight this blindness. Especially Surgical Expedition, SEA International, who have started with me this project in 1997. And together, involving also the Ministry of Health in Namibia, we have operated on more than 38,000 people in the neighboring countries also, Congo, Angola, Zimbabwe.
Congratulations to Dr. Helena Ndume. We are over a week into Ramadan now, and Bonnie, who listens to us in Dubai, sent us this. It is, of course, the sound of the call to prayer. I spoke to Bonnie, who told me why she likes it in Dubai.
I'm actually standing on my balcony right now. It's very quiet because the call to prayer has just sounded about 15 minutes ago, and people are inside having their dinner, the iftar, and being with their families. I can just barely hear two people rollerblading down the sidewalk just outside. There's leaves rustling in the wind, sometimes a cat fighting nearby. Sometimes it's my cat. Sometimes it's not. People walk by, the sidewalk goes beneath my balcony, and so I can hear their voices, the Doppler effect of their voices in many different languages, but not frequently. It's a very quiet place. It's just close enough to people to remember that there are other people on the planet, but secluded and beautiful enough to feel like it really is a haven.
Tell me about Ramadan in Dubai. We're a few days into it. Tell me a little bit more about how you see that being observed around you.
There's kind of a hush about the place during Ramadan, during the day. Depending on where you live in the city, you may or may not even notice that it's Ramadan. To be honest with you, where I am here, if it weren't for the call to prayer, that's almost the only thing that really tells me. But I also lived in Jumeirah for a while, which is a place where there are lots and lots of locals who live. And the decorations on the homes and the big cars parked outside where the families gathered every single evening, you can really feel the spirit of it. And charity, there's so much charity that goes on during Ramadan time. It's just a nice feeling time.
Bonnie emailed globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and so did Hans.
Hello, my name is Hans Johnson. I am a musician who splits his time between America and Kenya. The sound that makes me happy is the sound of others singing and having a good time. It's a long and beautiful story, I think, to how I came to travel to Kenya and record music, but when I heard Maasai music, which is almost purely vocal, it just struck a chord with me, no pun intended. Recently, I've been working with some singers to specifically collaborate on some music. I'm so grateful to them for sharing their music, and I think the music speaks to something that you necessarily can't write down on paper. But through music, we can express emotions and feelings that maybe can't be written down. This music brings me so much joy. So I thought, why not share with your listeners the beautiful, beautiful sounds of the Maasai singing?
Thanks to Hans, Bonnie, Andrew, Andrea, Mario, Gerardo and Isabel for taking part this week. And we'd love you to get involved too. Please tell us what you think of this new podcast or send us a voice note of the sound you love to hear. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Today's episode was brought to you by Studio Director Philip Ball, producers Olivia Noon and Tracy Gordon, and the editor Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. We're back next week.